Welcome to Catholic Answers Live, the program where you participate with your questions about apologetics and evangelization, including the most important theological, spiritual, moral, and social issues facing the world today. Call now with your question for today's guest, toll-free 1-888-31-TRUTH. That's 888-318-7884. Now, from San Diego, Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to our second hour here on Catholic Answers Live. This hour, a pro-life open forum. Any question that you might have about life, about the treatment of disease, about the care of life in its earliest stages, prenatal and postnatal, or care of life in its later stages, where people are terminal or maybe not terminal but are facing serious disabilities. All these things the Church has a great deal of experience with because, well, she has a long history of moral thought and teaching, but she also has the practical experience of lots of hospitals and care facilities and all that. And our guest this hour is part of that long Catholic tradition. Dr. George Delgado is the Director of Medical Services at the Culture of Life Family Family Services. Am I right, Dr. Delgado? Culture of Life Family?
That's right.
Yeah, okay. Sorry, I don't know why I panicked there for a second that I had it wrong.
That's okay.
Multiply board certified physician and has also studied at the National Catholic Bioethics Center to be prepared to answer these difficult ethical questions. Dr. Delgado, thanks for being with us.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
Again, 888-318-7884, our number, 888-318-7884. Any news from the pro-life front that we should be aware of or issues that are – I know that there are still some court cases moving through about free speech and the pro-life movement, but anything else?
There are lots of court cases. You know, an interesting case that was in many media outlets in early December about a successful birth after a uterus transplantation in Dallas. This was the first such case in the United States. There have been eight others in foreign countries. So this was a case where this woman was born with a uterus absent, so no uterus present. This probably happens in about 1 in 500 women who either have no uterus or the uterus is so malformed that it can't function the way it should. And so what they did was they took a uterus from a living donor and transplanted it into this woman, gave her immune suppression drugs, and then through in vitro fertilization implanted one or more embryos into her uterus. And one of them survived to term, and she delivered what appears to be a healthy baby. So most people would look at this and say, wow, what a great thing for this woman. She's able to have her own baby, which, of course, you know, that is great because a baby is always good news and it's always a blessing from God. But how that baby is created, how that baby is gestated, all that really poses some ethical issues that are very important that people, especially people who are not familiar with Catholic teaching on human sexuality and really aren't familiar with all the ins and outs of in vitro fertilization, what really happens there, they may not see that this is a huge red flag. Essentially, what's going on here is this woman is renting the womb for probably a few years because she's not going to keep that womb forever because she doesn't want to stay on immune suppression drugs forever. So this treatment did necessitate a cesarean section, and then she'll have the option of maybe having one more child that way. After that, she'll have the uterus removed and then, you know, discarded. So the ethical issues are, first of all, the exposure of the unborn baby to these immunosuppressant drugs. Do we really know if there are going to be any long-term consequences? I really don't think we do because we haven't studied this very long. That's the first thing. The second thing is the ethical situation of using someone else's uterus to gestate your own child. Are there going to be any effects of that? Because as we know, the pregnancy is really an intimate relationship between the child and the mother. And so sure, the child is in the mother's uterus, which now is her uterus, but some of the placental tissue arising from that uterus is not genetically hers. And so that intimate association of what's called the decidual basalis, the thin layer of the placenta that comes from the mother, and the chorion, the thick layer of the placenta that comes from the baby, well, that's been altered. And we don't really know what that alteration is going to entail, because we don't know all of the implications of that intimate relationship of mother and baby in the uterus there for 9 months. So those are things to consider. And then, of course, the larger issue, since it necessitates in vitro fertilization, which we know takes procreation out of the realm of the marital embrace and puts it in the hands of technicians. So it introduces at least one third party into this intimate relationship that should be exclusive to the husband and the wife. And that's why, one of the reasons why the church does not approve of in vitro fertilization. So lots of ethical issues there.
Yeah.
Not to mention that many times multiple embryos are created in the laboratory, and there is a type of laboratory eugenics that goes on, in that the fittest embryos are selected to be implanted. Those that don't look so good under the microscope, they're either killed or frozen for later use. And that, of course, is not a dignified way to treat a human embryo who is a human person, by either freezing that person or by killing that person.
So I just want to clarify one thing. So with this uterine transplant, which is not a lifelong transplant, it's temporary, but this mother is not able to conceive in a natural way. I mean,
that's correct.
I see. Okay, so that's so there wouldn't even be the possibility of conceiving in a natural way with this.
There wouldn't, because they're just transplanting the uterus and the cervix. So the woman's ovaries are not really connected in a way that they would be normally with a normal uterus and cervix. And in fact, some of these women who have absent or dysfunctional uterus also may lack ovaries, or may lack normal ovaries, and they may actually need to have egg donation from another woman. So that's the next layer if that woman lacks those ovaries.
It's layers and layers and layers, isn't it?
Yes.
Well, I'm glad we have you here to help us sort it out. Is it possible that at any there may be a time in the future where a mother whose ovaries are working but has a uterine problem may receive some kind of ethical reconstruction of her uterus, or artificial, or something like that?
Yeah. Now, that's possible if the cervix were operating and functioning normally, because the cervix is very important in order to transport the sperm into the uterus and then into the fallopian tubes, which is where fertilization takes place. So it's theoretically possible that if they were able to transplant an intact uterus with normal fallopian tubes that could interact normally with the ovaries of the woman, that this might be on the edge of ethical acceptability.
I see.
But that's a long ways off.
But a husband and wife are facing these kinds of fertility problems, and this one seems to be insurmountable. I mean, the organs are simply not functioning in a way that's going to allow that. Is there a resistance in your experience as a doctor who works in these? Is there resistance, or do you even mention this to people, to the idea that there are children who are ready to be adopted? How do people take that option?
Well, it all depends. There are really three groups of people I see. One is those who feel that it's their right to have a baby that's somehow biologically theirs, and to somehow gestate a baby and even to create a baby in the laboratory. For them, they're really not going to listen. There's another group who are faithful Christians who understand the whole meaning of sexuality and get it right away, that this is not something, that this is a line they don't want to cross, and they realize that there's just not going to happen naturally, and that barring some miracle, that they should pursue adoption, and they do, and they readily do that because they know that that's what God has planned for them. And then there's another group who really are not very ethically sophisticated and maybe don't have a strong religious background, but they see that this is too much, that there's an excess here, that this is over the top.
Yeah.
That doing all of this very intensive and really risk-bearing treatments that also is very expensive, it really is too much and that they don't need to go there. And so those are the ones who also pursue adoption. But, you know, what people need to really understand is that when a husband and wife marry, they have the right to each other's bodies. They have the right to be intimate with each other, as long as it's respectful and of course, consensual. But they don't really have a right to bear children. The children that are the fruit of their marital embrace are a gift from God. And so gifts are not rights, they're gifts. And so it's something that sometimes we're given those gifts, sometimes not, and we have to be able to accept that.
Yeah, and adoption is a great option. I mean, as an adoptive father, I like to tell people it's a great option.
Like, it is.
Stop worrying, and it works out. Anyway, I don't want to preach to folks. Let's take a quick break. We'll be right back with your calls for Dr. George Delgado on this pro-life open forum right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
We're ready and waiting for your call today on Catholic Answers Live.
Christmas is coming, and with Advent already upon us, we want to make sure you know about our annual Christmas sale with hundreds of great faith-building resources, all on sale at 20% off when you enter promo code WINTER at checkout. With great new resources on Scripture, church history, the saints, Bible prophecy, and so much more, there's simply no better time to stock up on resources to build up your faith and the faith of those around you. Phone 888-291-8000 or go to the shop at Catholic.com right now to take advantage of what is truly the best Catholic sale on the Internet, going on now through the end of the year. And remember, enter promo code WINTER at the checkout to save 20% on hundreds of great resources throughout the store.
Layla Rose says, Trent Horn really knows how to get people thinking and talking about abortion. Persuasive Pro-Life is an invaluable handbook for anyone who wants to become more skilled at defending the humanity of the preborn. Order your copy of Persuasive Pro-Life today by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting the online shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Catholic Answers Live is brought to you in part by CatholicSingles.com, the website for Catholics who want to meet others who share their Catholic values for faith, fellowship, and love. You can learn more at CatholicSingles.com. Catholic Answers Live thanks CatholicSingles.com for their generous support.
Pope Francis said, "All of us are called to mature in our work as evangelizers. We want to have better training, a deepening love, and a clear witness to the gospel." St. Paul Street Evangelization's online school of evangelization will equip you with the tools you need to be an effective evangelist. We'll ask for a pledge of financial support, but if you're unable to give, we'll set you up for free. Find out more and get involved today at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
Call now with your question, 888-318-7884. This is Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Dr. George Delgado is our guest this hour, and it is a pro-life open forum. If you have questions about life in its early stages, its late stages, or when it is in crisis or otherwise in its middle stages, we welcome those calls. We hope can help you work through some ethical issues. 888-318-7884. Because we had Father Hugh in here before, I slipped and called Dr. George Delgado, Father George Delgado. But then I just found out there is a Father Delgado. You have a brother who's a priest up in Stockton.
That's right.
So maybe we can get him on sometime. I don't know why.
He does some Spanish radio, and
he does
English radio too. Yes.
Yeah, we got to do more Spanish language stuff around here. William in Hillsboro, New Jersey, listening on the Catholic Answers Live app. You are on with Dr. George Delgado. Your question, please.
Hi, thank you. Hi, doctor. My wife took my girls to the doctor recently, and he was recommending, I think it was like an HPV drug, just in case they're sexually active. And so we didn't know if that's something, like, from a faith perspective, that's something the church approves, or even the risk around some of those drugs. And he was pushing it kind of hard, and, you know, at this point we have decided not to do anything with that. But just want to get your thoughts on that.
Sure. And how old are your daughters?
One is 11, one is 14.
Okay. Yeah, so this is it's not a drug. It's called the HPV or human papillomavirus vaccine. And it turns out that cervical cancer, cancer of the cervix of the uterus, is almost always related to human papillomavirus infection. And the human papillomavirus is a large family of different viruses. Any of you who've ever had warts on your hands or on your legs or on your feet, these warts are caused by another type of human papillomavirus. Well, it turns out there's another type that likes to infect the cervix. And usually when it does that, the body clears it out and it's fine. But there are some people, some women who develop a chronic infection with it, and then that can lead to changes in the cells of the cervix, which can then become, down the road, cancer of the cervix. So that's why this vaccine was developed. So in and of itself, it's not a bad thing. So it's really a prudential decision of whether you should have it. In and of itself, the vaccine is not really morally good or bad, and the church does not come out any way with any opinion because of that. So what some people have a concern, though, that if you give a vaccine whose sole purpose is to prevent a sexually transmitted infection, does that give a signal to the girl receiving it and to boys receiving it, because the boys are getting it now too, that they're, quote, safer and that they have less risk if they do try to engage in sexual relations? So that's the first concern that many responsible parents have. The second concern is that, like any vaccine, it's not without side effects and risks. So this vaccine, there have been about 10 reported deaths of girls after receiving the vaccine. We're not sure why. Some of them, they've fainted and hit their heads, other things. But there have been some deaths associated with it. And so if you are certain that your daughters are going to be chaste and sexually abstinent until they're married, then what's the rush of giving an 11-year-old a vaccine that she's not going to need? So that's the thing to consider. What I do recommend to some of my Catholic families in my practice, who I know they have daughters, I know them well, and I know the daughters are living good, chaste lives, I tell them, well, you know, if you're going to be a virgin until you're married, which is your plan, why not just get it sometime before you get married in case your future husband has not been chaste his entire life? That would be a very reasonable thing to do. Or to give it later in life. But to give an 11 and a 14-year-old in a situation where the family is a good family, where they know what their daughters are doing, and the daughters are living chaste lives, might not be the best thing. For some families, it might be, but others maybe not. So I think it's a prudential decision that you and your wife have to make. Could go either way. Does that make sense?
Apparently. Yeah, thank you. That was quite a good explanation. Just one quick follow-up. I wasn't in the meeting, but apparently he made it sound like it had to be done before a certain age, before they were, I don't know, 14, 15, maybe to be more effective. Is that true?
No, he's making an assumption that your daughters are going to become sexually active at age 16. It's true. It's less effective if it's given after a girl or a woman starts to have intercourse, because she could get infected, and then once you have the infection, the vaccine doesn't do much. So it's equally effective at any time in life, as long as it's given before a woman is infected with HPV, if she ever gets infected. So I would say that it should be given before the start of sexual activity. But that statement tells me that he has the common prejudice that all girls are going to become sexually active by the time they're 16, which, of course, is not true. And it's not the message we want to send our children either. So you have to be careful the message that this doctor is sending your daughters also. And I would say be careful of that doctor requesting or demanding that he meet with your daughters without you in the room, because that's a common thing, and I think we have to be careful with that unless we know it's a very good ethical doctor who adheres to Catholic principles.
Thanks, William. Do appreciate that call. It is a pro-life open forum this hour on Catholic Answers Live. Our guest is Dr. George Delgado. Our number, 888-318-7884. We go now to Nikki in Lyford, Texas, listening on EWTN. Nikki, your question for Dr. George Delgado.
Hello. I was pregnant recently, and when I went into the OBGYN, they were very adamant on my husband and I using protection, since they were afraid for the baby to get Zika. And I told them, well, I'm Catholic. We can't use protection. And since then, I have not been able to find out what exactly to do. And my second question is, I just had a miscarriage, and the baby was only 8 weeks. What is the proper thing to do for the baby? Because my OBGYN gave me the option to either let my body do what it normally does or give me a pill and induce the process and kind of just sit on the toilet. I didn't feel that that was right, and I don't know if we should have a funeral. I mean, the baby's so small. I don't know what is the right thing to do.
Yeah, well, first of all, I'm sorry you had a miscarriage, but, you know, the 8-week baby is still, that corpse is still as much of a corpse as if any of us died. And what do we do with corpses? We treat them with respect, and we're called to do that. And one of the corporal works of mercy is to bury the dead. So fortunately, many Catholic cemeteries have a section for miscarried babies. And so you can take the remains of your unborn baby who died, and you can have a funeral, and you can have a proper burial there. And it's usually relatively low cost because it doesn't take up a lot of room. It's actually often easier than, a newborn who dies, because until most state laws stipulate that a miscarriage before 20 weeks does not necessitate a death certificate. So there's usually less red tape involved. But I would. Do you still have the remains of your baby?
Baby is still.
Baby hasn't come out yet. Okay.
Right.
I'm sorry. Yeah. So if you can either whether you let things go naturally or you take the medication to induce the contractions, you don't have to let the baby fall in the toilet, which would be would not be a dignified way to treat the remains. You can just have a bedpan under you on the toilet, let's say, and that way anything that comes out, you can catch it there, and then you can see if the baby is in there. So that's what I would suggest. And then in the meantime, contact your Catholic cemetery and find out the section that where they allow burial for these unborn babies, and they'll help you with that. And then contact your parish priest too. The other question about the Zika, had you been exposed to the Zika virus or your husband? Had you traveled to an area and gotten mosquito bites?
No, but where we live, there have been some cases. So all the doctors just started saying, use protection.
Okay. Yeah, so I think they're overreacting, because even though there have been a few cases in the southern part of the United States, there have not been a lot except for that one neighborhood in Miami. So I think they're overreacting, number one. Number two, you're right in saying you should not use condoms, because when you have intercourse and you use condoms, then you are no longer giving totally of yourself to your husband. And he's no longer giving totally to you. And so remember your marriage vows, that you promise to give yourselves one to another in good times and in bad, in sickness and in health. And so this is not one of the best times when you're worried about whether you have Zika, but you still promise to give yourself entirely to one another. And so by using condoms, you destroy that total gift of self. So what are you to do? Well, then you have to make a decision. Either A, you take that small risk that maybe he could transmit the Zika virus to you, or you're extra cautious and you abstain, at least during the first part of the pregnancy when the baby's most susceptible to Zika virus, or abstain throughout the whole pregnancy. And either of those, I think, in your case, would be good choices. If you were in an area where there was a very high risk of Zika, I would advise to abstain, because, the risk is greater. But I think for you, either of those would have been good choices. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay.
Nikki, thank you very, very much for that call. Did you have a follow-up, Nikki, that you wanted to ask about? You sounded like...
No, that was it.
Okay, very good. All right, thank you. It's a pro-life open forum this hour with Dr. George Delgado, our guest. Dr. Delgado is the Director of Medical Services at the Culture of Life Family Services, not far from us here in San Diego. Dr. Delgado, are things like Culture of Life Family Services becoming more common, places where you can get full health care for the family that's pro-life?
It's becoming more common for different pro-life centers to expand their services, not necessarily to the extent that we have. There are, you know, a handful of clinics like ours across the country, but there are more and more that are offering increasing number of services, like Obria as a franchise model.
All right. Well, we have to take a break. We'll be right back with more Pro-Life Open Forum after this on Catholic Answers Live.
We're here for you. Give us a call today on Catholic Answers Live.
It might be said that anti-Catholic notions of the Church's history are the original fake news. With all the misinformation being spread, where does one look for the truth? In The Real Story of Catholic History, Professor Steve Weidenkopf gives you the facts on over 50 of the most common misconceptions about Catholic history and shows how to answer them simply and powerfully. Whether it's to answer claims about Catholicism's supposedly pagan origins, old myths about the Inquisition that never seem to go away, or more modern errors that anti-Catholics put forth, The Real Story of Catholic History is an essential resource for every Catholic's bookshelf. Order your copy of The Real Story of Catholic History today by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
As the legend goes, the Protestant Reformation began when Martin Luther nailed the list of his grievances with the Catholic Church to the door of All Saints Church in Wittenberg, Germany. But do you know the whole story? In Catholic Answers' brand new documentary, The Protestant Revolution, you will hear from top apologists Tim Staples, Jimmy Akin, Carla Broussard, Trent Horn, and Steve Weidenkopf as they expose the errors of Martin Luther and of the other so-called reformers. This DVD will give you a clearer understanding of our Protestant brothers and sisters, and you will be better equipped to engage them about what separates us and about what unites us. Order your copy of The Protestant Revolution today by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting shop.catholic.com, or by asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
The Trump administration rolls back the Health and Human Services contraceptive mandate.
U.S. bishops calling for the total elimination of nuclear weapons.
Pope Francis offers prayers for the victims of the California wildfires.
The U.S. House of Representatives has passed a bill banning abortions after 20 weeks.
And Pope Francis says the death penalty is contrary to the gospel.
Your link to news headlines Catholics count on at the top of the hour. Weekdays on EWTN Radio.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Kellett, your host. Dr. George Delgado is our guest this hour for a pro-life open forum. I want to just remind you that you can get our free ebook, The Case for Christmas, Answers to Attacks on Christmas, for free. That's why we call it a free ebook, because you can get it for free. You just go to Catholic.com, and at the top you'll see a banner, free ebook banner. Click on that and you get the free ebook, and it's got all kinds of great information on answering some of the common attacks made on Christmas from non-Christians. And, you know, some of these attacks are made from other Christians as well, although that's less common than it used to be in the olden days. Still, there are some Christians who are opposed to the celebration of Christmas. So if you want to stick up for Christmas, go get the free ebook at Catholic.com. Let's go now to our next caller is Dave in Tacoma, Washington, listening on KBLE. Dave, your question for Dr. George Delgado.
Yes, I really like listening to your show, and I was just wondering what the Church's teaching is on abortion, and if the Church teaches that abortion is sinful, and I wonder if a person has an abortion, if they could be forgiven by the Church, and I'll listen to the answer off the air.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks, Dave. Well, first, I think the most important question there is, can someone be forgiven if she has an abortion or if he is involved with an abortion? And of course, as long as the person is willing to accept God's forgiveness, then every sin is forgivable, and as long as that person repents and asks for forgiveness. So yes, absolutely. The worst sins that we could possibly commit are meager in comparison to God's infinite mercy. So we must always remember that. We must never fall into the sin of despair. So that's the most important, I think, take-home point of your question. And as far as the church's teaching on abortion, the church is very, very clear on what is technically called direct abortion, and that means an intended abortion, somebody that causes the death of an unborn baby, and that's the motive of that action. And that's what we commonly just refer to as plain old abortion. Because what is abortion? Abortion is the killing of an innocent human being. And we know that the Ten Commandments tell us, thou shalt not kill. And the killing of an innocent person is always wrong. And no argument has ever been made that can convince me or anyone who is of reasonable mind and a reasonable person that killing an unborn baby is ever killing an aggressor. An unborn baby is never an aggressor. The unborn baby is always innocent and is always in the place where he or she should be during those 9 months, and that's in the mother's uterus. So no one could ever say that the unborn baby is attacking the woman is any way guilty of anything, because the unborn baby cannot be guilty of anything. So that's why abortion is always wrong. Objectively, it's always a sin. Of course, subjectively, we can never judge people. Only God can do that. So I can't say that any particular act is necessarily a sin, because a person could be misled, could be coerced. A lot of things can go into it. But objectively speaking, yes, abortion is a sin unequivocally, and the church has always taught that really since the early days of the time of the apostles. There's a work of the teaching of the apostles called the Didache, which is the first post-biblical written teaching, and in there it condemns abortion.
Thanks very much for that call. I'd like to read a question to you from Facebook. Lots of questions on Facebook today for you, Dr. Delgado. This one comes from Karen. She says her grandson was created in a little dish using the natural egg and sperm of the married parents. The child was carried in surrogacy by his aunt and then given to the natural parents. And she says, what is the ruling on this, please? I know you don't give rulings, but how do we understand the moral situation there with that?
Right, yeah. So a couple of troublesome moral points here is, first of all, the created in a little dish is in vitro fertilization. So there, again, like we discussed earlier, the child was created outside of the marital embrace, and it involved a third agent, a technician who mixed the sperm and the egg together. And that's not how God intended for us to be created. God intended for us to be created by and in the mother's body, in the fallopian tubes, by an act of natural intercourse. And that's how we participate in procreation. We're in a way co-creators with God in that sense. But when we perform in vitro fertilization or create a child in a little dish, what happens is that we are really rebelling against God's plan and destroying the exclusivity of the husband and wife right there. So that's why the church says that in vitro fertilization is not allowable, never is allowable. Next, the child was carried as a surrogate by his aunt. That means that after being created in the dish, this little human person was then implanted in his aunt's uterus after she was hormonally stimulated to make the uterus receptive. So this involved great danger to the unborn child. The transfer and the take had some risks, and it may not have been successful. But also, this again violated the exclusivity of the marital relationship, where the child should be not only a product of the marital embrace, but also should be gestated, should be carried for 9 months in his or her mother's womb. the child has the right to that, to be carried in his or her own mother's womb, not in the womb of another person. Again, a third party being introduced into this, what should be an exclusive relationship. So having said that, this whole process is not in accord with church teachings. It is in violation of the natural law. But again, we have to stop and remember that this little baby that was produced in this way, he or she is not guilty of anything, did not have any say in how he or she was created or gestated, and therefore that little child still has as much value as all of us, is still a gift from God, because God keeps his promise of giving us a new child whenever that sperm and egg unite, even if it does not occur the way he wants it. So God is always faithful, even if we're not faithful. So that child should in no way really have to suffer or be punished or be felt as inferior because he or she was created in a way that was not the way God intended. So it's important to keep that in mind. Hope that answers Karen's question.
Karen, thanks very much for that question on Facebook. Let's go now to Mike in San Antonio, Texas, listening on Guadalupe Radio. Mike, your question for Father George Delgado. Excuse me, Dr. George Delgado.
We're going to have to get my brother on this program.
I know. Well, I got Father Hugh Barber on the brain from the previous hour. Mike, sorry to make you wait. Your question for Dr. Delgado.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. My question is about what I believe is about the term is, I think it's called snowflake babies, and that there are millions, I've heard that there are millions of frozen embryos in various facilities around the country that seem to be resigned to either stay in a frozen state or someday discarded, and their only chance at a full life is to be implanted into a woman's uterus. And I've heard that there are women who want to, quote, rescue them by, having them be implanted in their own uteruses. But I've heard that the church doesn't consider that morally illicit. So I guess my question is, A, is that true? And B, if that is true, I understand the church's teaching on what we were talking about tonight here about a child deserves to be the product of a mother and father in the marital embrace. But it seems that the church is against this baby that's already existing through no fault of his own in the state. It seems almost analogous to like if the church is against it, like if I knew there was a child in a building that was in danger and I had to break into the building to get him, that like, well, you can't break into it because that's breaking and entering and that's a crime. So what's the church's teaching on it and why, I guess?
Yeah, Mike, actually that's a very interesting analogy you present about breaking into the building. And it is a little different from that. And first of all, it's important to know that the church has not made a formal proclamation on these snowflake embryos. And you're right, there are probably hundreds of thousands, not millions, however, in the United States that are human embryos who are fast frozen in a state of suspended animation. Their development has been arrested. And perhaps around the world there might be more, but in other countries they actually tend not to allow the freezing and storage of human embryos because they know that it's an ethical landmine field. Unfortunately, here in the United States, they do allow that. So the question is this, it's certainly a good intention to try to, quote, save these babies and give them the opportunity to develop into babies and then into adults. However, Pope John Paul II did comment on this in one of his documents, and he said that this is a situation where their moral status is absurd. And in other words, he implied that perhaps there's no good ethical solution to this problem. And there are some cases where we never have a good ethical way out of something. There just is no good thing to do. And the analogy I use to that is if you've squeezed the toothpaste out of the tube, you can't get it back in. It's just one of those things. And for me and for many Catholic bioethicists, that's what we feel about this. There are some good Catholic bioethicists who feel that the embryo transfer, the snowflake adoption, is ethically acceptable. But I would say that most of the good Catholic bioethicists, and including Father Tad at the National Catholic Bioethics Center, feel that this is not a good solution and that there really is no ethical way out of this. And the reason why is that, again, it goes back to that, what the right of the human being is, and the preborn baby, the human embryo, has a right to be gestated, to spend its time in the uterus of his or her own mother. And again, because that's a very intense relationship, physiologically, probably emotionally, and maybe spiritually, that close contact, none of us will ever have a more intimate relationship than being in the womb of our mothers, if you can think about that. Think about the complexity of it and the depth of that relationship of being in the womb of a mother. And so to destroy that exclusivity and place that baby in the womb of another mother, we feel that is not ethically acceptable. It goes so far against the plan of God. And so you're saying, well, what about the fate of these babies, these unborn babies who are frozen, these embryos who are frozen? Well, in some ways, their fate has already been decided. And what many feel is that they should be treated with respect and kind of like a person on life support. Maybe withdrawing life support is appropriate, perhaps letting them fall, or just keeping them frozen and knowing that over time, a percentage of them are going to die over time, and this is the most natural death that they could have. I've also thought about maybe it would be appropriate, since these are living human persons, that maybe taking the cover off the container and baptizing them, and then knowing that, you know, they will die, but baptize them so they have a baptism. That's something I haven't read about much, but that's certainly something that should be considered.
Mike.
So it's a difficult topic, but I hope that gives you some perspective on it.
Thank you very much for the call, Mike. We have to take a quick break. We'll be right back with more Dr. George Delgado, Pro-Life Open Forum this hour on Catholic Answers Live, right after this.
This is Harry Connick Jr., and you're listening to Catholic Answers Live.
Homeschool Connections, an online provider of courses for your Catholic homeschool, is a sponsor of Catholic Answers Live. Homeschool Connections' website is homeschoolconnections.com.
Howdy, folks. This is Jimmy Akin. Christmas is coming and Advent's already upon us, so we want to make sure that you know about our annual Christmas sale with hundreds of great faith-building resources all on sale at 20% off when you enter the promo code WINTER at checkout. We've got great new resources on Scripture, church history, the saints, my new book on Bible prophecy, and so much more. There's no better time to stock up on resources to help build your faith and the faith of those around you. Just phone 888-291-8000 or go to the online shop at Catholic.com right now to take advantage of this great Catholic sale going on now through the end of the year. Remember, enter the promo code WINTER at checkout to save 20% on hundreds of great resources throughout the store.
The Catholic Answers Minute. I'm Father Vincent Cerf. In Matthew 11:28, Jesus said to the crowds, "Come to me, all you who labor and are burdened, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am meek and humble of heart, and you will find rest for yourselves. For my yoke is easy and my burden light." A yoke is a kind of harness that enables two animals of burden to pull the same load. If we choose to join Jesus in bearing his burden, we will find the peace and fulfillment that is only given to the humble. This means sharing the loads of others and helping them to see that in bearing our burdens, we have something to offer back to him. By doing this, we will one day know how he was walking with both of us. I'm Father Vincent Cerpa for Catholic Answers, Catholic.com.
Call now with your question, 888-318-7884. This is Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live, Pro-Life Open Forum. We are proud to be pro-life. We are happy to be pro-life. We are grateful to God for life. And but we also know it needs an intellectual defense, this pro-life position that we take, the idea that human life is sacred, precious, and inviolable from conception to natural death. And so that's why we have Dr. George Delgado with us to help us understand, help us work through on an intellectual level why we make the moral choices that we make, why the church, for example, teaches what she teaches about the life of human beings and how those lives are to be treated. We go now to Damien in Australia watching on YouTube. Thanks for calling from Australia, Damien. Your question for Dr. Delgado.
G'day, guys. I really love the show. It's really good to have something to help me answer my difficult questions. My mum is a Protestant, and I've come to the Catholic Church, and she asked me a very difficult question when it came to contraception, asking about uterine prolapse and, you know, what Catholics should do, because obviously we teach that contraception is wrong, and so a surgery that creates contraception would also be wrong. What about in cases like uterine prolapse?
Well, that's a good question, and I would rephrase your statement. It's a surgery that creates infertility if the uterus is removed, not that it creates contraception, because that's a different connotation. But with if a woman is fertile and she has any disease of the uterus, then the proper treatment should be done that has the least effect on fertility, but that is effective for treating whatever the condition, and whether that's a condition is a prolapse, and a prolapse is when the uterus falls down into the vagina and can create a lot of discomfort and can create urinary problems, or if it's a cancer or a precancerous condition of the uterus, or if there's excessive bleeding, whatever it might be, you choose the best treatment. And there may be a role for prudential choice where there might be several treatments that are acceptable, but you can apply what's called the principle of double effect. And what that means is that, let's say you have a uterine prolapse, that the best treatment would be to remove the uterus. And so you have one action, and that is removing the uterus. It has two effects. One effect is to cure the woman of the consequences of the uterine prolapse, but the second consequence or effect is that she's no longer fertile. The first effect is what is desired, and it's a good effect. The second effect is not desired, but it is foreseen. And the two can be considered to be of relatively equal magnitude. And if there's no better way to accomplish the treatment, then all the conditions of the principle of double effect are met, and the woman could proceed with that treatment. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. Now, thank you so much for the answer.
You're welcome.
Thanks very much for that call. Very cool to get a call from Australia. Gil in Manhattan, New York. Gil, you are on with Father George Delgado. Your question, please, Gil.
Yes, hi. I want to ask a question and reiterate a verse. In 1 Corinthians 6:19, it says, "Do you not know that your body is a temple of the Holy Spirit who is in you? For you are not your own. You were bought at a price. Therefore, glorify God in your body and your spirit, which are God's." In light of that, I want to ask what you think about in vitro fertilization in light of that, why it's wrong according to this verse.
Well, exactly right, because the body is a temple of the Holy Spirit, and so we are to treat our bodies reverently and with respect and in the way that God intended. And so we have to remember that we are stewards of our bodies. We are not the masters. God is the master. And so in order to fully reverence your temple of the Holy Spirit, then you should proceed with procreation the way God designed it and intended it, and not take it out of its context and not introduce third parties into that mutual exclusive relationship of husband and wife coming together where their two temples of the Holy Spirit become one, the two become one flesh. And that's how God intended a new person to be created, because really when we procreate, we are not only are we treating our temples of the Holy Spirit appropriately within marriage, but we also are mirroring the Holy Trinity. The Holy Trinity is the Father and the Son love each other so much there's a total outpouring of the love, a total union so great that the result of that love is another person, the Holy Spirit. And so that's exactly what we're doing with marital procreation, is that we're imaging that. It's a human image of that Trinity. And so when you use in vitro fertilization to create a human embryo, it's still a human person, of course, but you're not mirroring that Trinitarian relationship like God intended. And so that's why that verse actually supports the prohibition of in vitro fertilization.
Gil, how does that strike you?
It sounds good, because Genesis 2:24, for the people that are listening, says, "For this reason, a man will leave his father and mother and be united to his wife, and the two will become one flesh, not three."
Oh, what a fascinating take. Yeah, that's an interesting point.
That's very good. Yeah, that's a wonderful use of that verse.
Gil, thanks very much for the call. Call again sometime.
God bless you. I send you a big electronic hug on the air.
Oh, thank you very much. Those are very dangerous, though, those electronic hugs. If you have one foot in water, it can be extremely painful.
They're electrifying.
Yeah. Cheryl on Facebook writes the following. What would you say to those who say the fetus is a parasite who wouldn't live without the mom's body? What is the defense against this?
Well, unfortunately, this is an old argument that seeks to justify abortion. And again, the human embryo and fetus does not meet the definition of a parasite, because a parasite, by definition, is an organism of another species that lives on or in a member of another species and causes harm to it. However, the human embryo and fetus, the unborn baby, is not a separate species. It's of the same species, and it's actually, of course, procreation of the mother who's carrying that baby. So the argument falls flat on its face from the get-go. What it seeks to do is it seeks to dehumanize the human person who is an embryo or a fetus. And of course, we know, and being pro-life, is that the human being, no matter how small, is a human being. And a human being, no matter how small or how young, should be respected with all the respect that any human being deserves. Along that continuum, from the time a sperm and an egg unite to create the zygote, which quickly becomes the embryo, to the fetus, to the newborn baby, to the child, to the adult, to the elderly adult, and to the declining adult, any person along that continuum deserves equal respect and all have equal value in God's eyes and should have equal value in all of our eyes. So to say that any human being is a parasite is really pejorative, and it's not in keeping with the dignity of the human being.
Cheryline, thanks very, very much for that question. You know, Dr. Delgado, one of the things I notice when you are on for these pro-life open forums is they very quickly develop a theme. If somebody asks about, today it was about in vitro fertilization. We had lots and lots of questions about that. Then we tend to follow that theme. And for example, today, I don't believe we handled, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but a single question about end-of-life issues, which are also an area where, let's say, the cultural innovators are trying to improve our lives by the greater, more liberal use of death. Did you want to say anything about what's happening with end-of-life things, where we are with increased doctor-assisted suicide and euthanasia, those kinds of things, before we close today?
Sure. Well, it is certainly very distressing that the ethic in medicine is that a life at the end that does not have perceived quality can be and should be ended either by omission or by commission. And that, unfortunately, is becoming more prevalent. And it's also becoming more prevalent where families who have elderly members who are sick will, without even hesitating, sometimes give the assent to withdrawal feeding when that feeding is being tolerated. And the withdrawal feeding in those cases, of course, is to hasten the death of that person. So I think we really have to be aware of that and really have to be on guard of that and know that these people, our elderly family members, no matter how frail, no matter how incapacitated, no matter how much of a burden they seem to be to all of us, they have intrinsic value, and we need to protect their dignity and protect their lives without going overboard and giving them burdensome treatments or providing food and nutrition when they can't handle it, but always giving them what they deserve and all the love that they need and not hastening their death.
Thank you very much. Dr. George Delgado has been our guest. He's the Director of Medical Services at Culture of Life Family Services. That's COLFS, COLFS.org, if you'd like more information. I'm right about that. COLFS.org, right?
That's right.
All right. Tomorrow, open forum, both hours. Bring it. 888-318-7884. Start dialing now. 2 hours, open forum. Anything you want to know about Catholic life, faith, or history tomorrow on Catholic Answers Live.